You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluids?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I've got one word for you, just to describe what this show is about: boobs. It's funny. We talk a lot about genitals on this show. I was just thinking, like, how many times I say vulva. Is it every week? I don't know. But maybe we haven't focused an entire show around boobs, which seems like, I don't know. It doesn't seem right. It seems like we have to correct that, and we're going to start today. Let me tell you about my guest. Leslie Lair is a prize-winning author, an essayist for the New York Times Modern Love column, and the novel consultant for Truby's Writers Studio. After being size AA to quadruple D through breast envy, breastfeeding, breast implants, and breast cancer, she realized she's obsessed with breasts. Turns out she's not alone. And her new book, which she's going to talk about today, is called A Boob's Life: How America's Obsession with Breasts Shaped Me and You. And Publishers Weekly, which is a really big deal in the publishing industry, gave it an early rave. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Leslie.
Thank you, Tristan. I'm so excited to be here.
So, what a ride. I was going to say, like, this book is such a ride, but really, it's your life.
Yeah.
It's quite a ride.
Not over yet, thank God. Not coming.
You're really not afraid to tell the truth, even if it's, well, if it's ugly, and even if it's about your own body. Now, of course, this is a sign of a good memoirist, right? But wow, were there any hesitations? Was there any voice inside your head? Was there any self-censorship where you said, oh my God, I shouldn't share this?
Not the stuff that's in the book. I really feel like all of us, our life is like a house, and a memoir is one room in that house. So there's plenty of stuff in my life that's not in the book. But in terms of how my life is according to my breasts, I kind of feel like this is what I have to say, and maybe this is how I got to here. This is maybe the most important thing I'm ever going to write. And if I don't reveal myself and understand these truths, this was really a detective story of how have breasts affected my life. I mean, breasts are like the white elephant, you know, in the room of sexual politics. They affect us so much, and we take it for granted. So for me, had I not bared my chest, and I think once you've been sick, also, my breasts are a science experiment. And boobs are really interesting. And you know, I wanted to find out more about them, and everything out there. You know, when you talk about breasts, you can find books on breast cancer and breastfeeding and chicken recipes. But you say boobs, I mean, even if you look at my listing on Amazon and say related boob, well, it's listed under feminist theory and women's history and all this stuff in the categories. But if you look underneath the algorithms that Amazon chose, it's porn. It's big boobs, lots of boobs, you know. So I feel like this is a topic that if I can start delving into the truth of it, it's fascinating to me, and maybe it'll be informative to all of us in this time when we all need to look at ourselves and look at each other, you know, in a new way.
It's fascinating to see how you trace the way boobs were these beacons, so to speak, that they framed your experience of girlhood, of womanhood, of relationships, of love, of sex, of marriage. So I congratulate you, just one writer to another, for I don't know anyone else who's made boobs a framing device.
Yeah. Although we frame our boobs every day. I mean, I don't know what kind of bra you're wearing today, but every morning.
I'm not.
We all make a decision.
It's COVID. I don't need to leave.
Exactly.
Yeah. And even when I do leave my house, I've become quite braless these days. You know.
I think COVID killed the bra, really.
Yeah. And I wonder if I'm just getting older or if they have, in fact, sank because they're not being constantly pushed up all day. I strangely put on a bra sometimes for Zoom meetings, like when I get dressed like fancy from the waist up. And then I question myself, like, why am I even wearing a bra? I'm home. It's weird.
No, it's part of the culture. That's kind of what I learned is, as much as I know now about how the culture and history and politics and advertising shaped everything, I'm still part of the culture and I still have to live in it. Yes. And so I will still, you know, shape myself in a presentable way in order to get along and feel like I'm treated how I want to be treated. So you can't fight where you live.
Okay. So let's talk about your early relationship with your boobs.
Well, they were too small. You know, you look at other people and you look at the grown-ups and you want to grow up and you want to be boobs. And I happened to grow up when they had just invented training bras, you know, and I didn't know that was a new invention, but yeah, I wanted to train my boobs to be big. And that's hard to do. I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio. It was all about cheerleaders and prom queens, and they all had the big boobs, and everyone on TV, Petticoat Junction had Hooterville. I mean, you know, I grew up in this critical time when big boobs were the holy grail. And so when I was little, they were small. I think, you know, the first time I got felt up, which is a rite of passage for every girl, you know, I was apologizing to the guy because they weren't much to feel, you know?
Oh, it's so interesting. Like you're even at that age, I think our culture has created self-conscious girls who are really self-conscious about their bodies. And we don't start out that way.
I don't know. I think it starts pretty early.
I meant we like don't come out of the womb feeling bad about our bodies.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no. It's not until someone shows us pictures of what we're supposed to look like or says, cover your nipples, you know, when you're a child. Right. You know, all the babies you see on the beach running around in a diaper, you wonder how long it's going to be till someone covers the little girl.
Right, and lets the little boy just keep going.
Right. And I think that's a big gender issue now, too. Breasts are a big part of a female aesthetic. And once you have them, you have to cover them.
Which is funny because people work hard to get them and purchase them, and then you have to cover them still.
Yes. Yeah. Especially the nipple. That's the intersection of, you know, the sacred and profane, I think. But when you're little, that's definitely when it starts. And once it's in your head, it's really hard to fight. I really love the whole body positivity movement now. But I was just thinking the other day, my Instagram feed is probably a little skewed towards that, because then when I get off of it, the real world is not so much.
Well, that's really good for your mental health, actually. People say that if you populate your feed with like role models and people who are expounding these really positive things, that actually, I think it actually can increase your own body image, like acceptance. It's actually a good thing, but I know what you mean. It's like you live in this bubble where everyone's super celebrating their bodies, and then you walk out your door and you're like, oh shit.
Right. But that is kind of a mission of my book. I mean, I want everybody, no matter what they look like, to feel equal and to be equal and have equal rights. But I also, I want you to love your boobs, you know, love, and I want to love my boobs. And it's a tricky thing. I mean, I talked to somebody recently who had just spent 2 years, like 12 surgeries, trying to get her boobs back after being sick. Mm. And, you know, other people, you know, I mean, obviously 300,000 women a year get breast implants. It's the most popular elective surgery. And the same number, about 300,000 women a year, get breast cancer. So it's like our breasts affect us from the very beginning. And when we're little, you know, we breastfeed if our moms, my mom did not breastfeed, so she had pretty nice looking breasts for a really long time. But getting back to when you're little, I think the images that we see, the models, the advertising, the television, it's hugely impactful. I mean, as mothers, you know, we're afraid of peer pressure, but everything we do, it's not just how we model ourselves. It's all around us. So yeah, anytime we can look at more, it's a good thing. more bodies,
yes.
More kinds more of breasts. Different.
Well, and I was struck, actually getting back to the nipple, Erica Hart is an amazing sex educator, teacher, activist, who had breast cancer and who got her nipples removed and chose not to have them grafted back on. And so she often appears topless in various contexts because she doesn't have nipples. She has breasts, but she doesn't have nipples. So often her images are not censored in the same way, which of course reveals the double standard right away. But I saw that she was on the cover of, I feel like it was like Elle or one of the big women's magazines in the UK. And there is a full frontal shot of her and her naked breasts, which seems very bold for sort of a mainstream women's magazine, and sort of does the opposite of kind of the push-up bra photoshopped kind of aesthetic. I mean, you can see her scars and you can see that she has no nipples, which can be startling at first. And so I'm wondering what the feedback is going to be like for that magazine, because it I was like, whoa, they did what? And I wonder also if people are going to censor it, if it's going to be censored, you know, the physical copy. Is it on the newsstands? No, she's on the digital cover. I think there's just more space there, right, to do it. The newsstands probably wouldn't take it.
Well, if she had her nipples tattooed on, which a lot of people do, they probably would have censored it.
Yes. Also, because I've seen some tattooed nipples, shout out to Ginger Bentham, who is one of the co-hosts of Life on the Swing Set. Oh my God. So she had a situation where she has a little bit of tissue. I forget where they got it. So she has a 3D nipple, you know? Right. And she got these tattoos of her nipples and they're like this incredible swirly kind of like the endless universe, multiple colors. They're so spectacular. I can't even describe them to you. They're so amazing. I mean,
I have to see this.
The tattoos have gotten really good, just quite frankly, the tattoo. Yeah. And also I saw her naked several times and had no idea. Maybe It was dark, but anyway, I've just said I saw Ginger naked. Hi, Ginger. you know, when I was growing up, this is what it starts you thinking about. Like, when was the first time you were aware of boobs and that you had some thoughts about boobs or some feelings about boobs? And so when I was growing up, I was born in 1971, and my mom was a feminist and she didn't wear a bra. So this was a particular moment in history, the sort of bra burning, which didn't actually happen, but the idea that the bra was a sort of tool of the patriarchy and we had to, you know, just put down all of these tools and resist them. And one thing for feminists was, we're not going to wear bras. And so my mom didn't wear a bra. And for me, as like 8-year-old me or 10-year-old me, I was horrified.
Yeah, you could see her nipples through a shirt.
I could see her nipples through a shirt. And she did breastfeed. So, you know, nipples, once you breastfeed, become thicker and bigger and more prominent, right?
Yeah.
So I was just horrified because every other mother, every other woman I saw in the world, no matter how flat-chested they were, wore a bra. I mean, that was clear to me. So she was breaking these rules. And as a kid, it's not like I came out the womb a feminist. As a kid, I was just like, why can't my mom just wear a bra? You know?
Yep.
And I didn't grasp entirely at that young of an age that it was a choice and it was a radical choice. And she was sort of making a statement in her gender presentation. I just felt like, why does my mom have to be different than all these other moms?
Yeah. the mom thing is pretty huge. I'm a little bit older than you, and I remember watching the Miss America contest on TV, and I was a little girl, and the camera kind of shook, and later we read about it, and I had been always stuffing my bathing suit as a little girl to try and look like those people. And when I, you know, the bra burning was really, well, it wasn't the burning, obviously, they just threw them away because they didn't have a fire permit, but they, which is interesting because it was written about that, like draft card burning.
Yes.
And they would only talk to female reporters, so they didn't get full coverage of what was really happening. But when I finally was able to wear, I was big enough to wear a bra, it had become a fashion where you had to be braless to be cool, to be against the war, to be a rebel. Mm. And so wanting to wear a bra was definitely a conflict of, are you cool? Are you not cool? Are you wearing a bra? Are you not? But my mom, she was teaching. She was part of Planned Parenthood. She was a professor at Ohio State, and she was a feminist, but then she was also very wedded to the old school of marriage as well. But Marlo Thomas didn't wear a bra, and that girl, and that was shocking.
Yes, shocking.
Because she was someone really respectable. Danny Thomas, Father of the Year, you know, all his shows, his daughter wasn't wearing a bra. But she was small-breasted, so it wasn't as big a deal as maybe your mom. And when it's at home, yeah, that can bring out a lot of shame and peer pressure maybe from your friends.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you know.
And I mean, I still grew up to be quite body positive. I mean, it's almost like the modeling was there and I resisted it and I didn't understand it. But now in retrospect, you know, I just really respect my mom that she was like, fuck these conventions. I'm not wearing a bra. But at the moment, I just didn't get it.
That's so cool, though.
My mom did a lot of cool things that like made me really mad when I was a kid. Like my parents didn't baptize me, and I grew up in a very strongly Catholic family and with a Catholic grandmother and in a mostly Catholic and Christian community. And the fact that I was not baptized was a big deal. Like people would often tell me I was going to hell.
Heathen.
Yeah. And so, like, I know that they said it. I know they said something when I said, like, why didn't you just baptize me? They said something like, well, we want you to choose your own spiritual path when you're old enough. And I was like, that is complete bullshit. When I'm like 10, you know? But now I'm like, God, thank God you didn't baptize me. And thank God you didn't indoctrinate me in the fucking Catholic Church. I would have so much more baggage.
Oh, yeah. But so when did you start wearing a bra? I mean, did you?
I was very flat chested. So I remember the girl in sixth grade who was the first person to wear a bra. I mean, it's such a weird thing to like keep in your memory, but I do. I know the exact person. Her name was Tracy. And yeah, so I was very, very flat chested. And I was one of those kids who was like 5 feet tall and weighed less than 100 pounds. I was just a tiny, skinny kid. I got my period late. I got my period when I was 16. And so
lucky you.
I was kind of a late, and I actually went into early menopause. So I had it great on both ends. So I was super flat chested, and actually I was just a late bloomer. Like finally all of a sudden, like I went to college and I got boobs and I got hips, right? Not big boobs, like B cups. But I remember going back to my hometown and seeing a bunch of people. And finally, my friend Julie pulled me aside because she was the only one who was like ready to say it to me straight. And she said, did you get a boob job? And I was like, what? No. I mean, I was so excited to finally have boobs, you know? But right. She was like, well, we just saw you and you had no boobs, you know, meaning a year ago, right? Meaning in high school.
Right.
And then I was like, oh my God, that's so shocking. But thanks for noticing I have boobs.
But that's how Mother Nature happens. But you know, in the 80s, the Society of Plastic Surgeons petitioned the FDA, and they called having small or no breasts a disease.
Yes. That was a fact. You know, your book, I want to tell people, has these sort of factoids and really interesting things about boobs. In the medical setting, boobs in pop culture, some really great statistics. That was a thing that I had no idea about.
Yeah, that paved the way for all these plastic surgeons to make money and have insurance companies pay for a great deal of it. And, you know, that was kind of certified big-breasted women in Playboy and, you know, having implants, and it was okay for them to have implants. And then the beauty queens, Mr. USA, you know, by the end of the century was mostly people with implants. Yeah. And, you know, but I mean, the movies, everyone had to be naked, and suddenly you had to, it was being Playboy was a way to be in the movies, you know, a lot of celebrities. I mean, the names expands, but the medical profession, I mean, it's just crazy. The whole, yeah, I mean, bigger is better. That's an American post World War II thing. And but it's true. Overnight, you can get breasts. I think there's a big thing of celebrities now we see is like, did she or didn't she? And, right. And the reality is, what does it matter?
Right.
You know?
Right. Okay, I do want to talk about Playboy, but we're going to take a break and hear from our great sponsors. When we come back, yeah, we got to talk about Playboy. We got to talk about boob jobs. We have to talk about your mother. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and get better sleep. And I'm one of them. Calm is the app designed to help you ease stress and get the best sleep of your life. Now more than ever, our world requires that we have tools for anxiety reduction, self-care, mindfulness, and healthful sleep. All of these things have helped me get through what is still a really difficult time on multiple levels. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories narrated by soothing voices like Kate Winslet, Chike Okonkwo, Harry Styles, Laura Dern, and Idris Elba. I mean, who doesn't want Idris Elba talking in their ear holes as they fall asleep? Oof. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library, and new content is added every week. Get started today at calm.com/TRISTAN. That's calm.com/Tristan. Get the Calm app and experience a transformation in the way you sleep. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. This new book is called A Boob's Life: How America's Obsession with Breasts Shaped Me and You. And it's by prize-winning author Leslie Lair. Leslie, before the break, you brought up Playboy, and Playboy does make actually several appearances in your story. And interestingly, at different times in your story, so like in different decades. Yeah. But Playboy, for many people who are our age or older, I'm about to be 50, Playboy was kind of our first exposure, could have been our first exposure to seeing naked women's bodies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my dad had a row of leather-bound albums of Playboy by the year. And when he was in college, they had it in the college library. You didn't have to check it out. It was just out there to be borrowed.
At Princeton,
and I gotta
by the
tell
way,
you,
at Princeton.
Yeah, Princeton, you know, supposedly the smartest kids. And I got to say, what I didn't realize about Hefner, who invented, you know, started Playboy, was that he was raised by these Puritan parents who didn't give him any affection at all. They were known to not be huggers. So he was a straight guy, well-read, liked Esquire, who did all the articles and had the Vargas girl illustrations that he then, you know, took for a Playboy. But he got engaged and his fiance cheated on him. And he went ahead and married her. But I feel like his whole development of what kind of man are you? You're the Playboy kind of man, was just totally revenge on his wife. And he just made it his life's goal to then, you know, I want to swear now.
You can swear.
To totally mess with, okay, to fuck over every other woman on the planet, you know, by making these men who thought it was their gift to do whatever they wanted and have all these bimbos and whatever. And Playboy really influenced generations of men and certainly these men. And at the same time, at the early 60s was when TVs were suddenly in every home. There didn't even used to be TV, and then suddenly it's in your home, and then it's color. And then advertising came about, and here's the biology, is men will look at a woman's breasts within 200 milliseconds of her entering the room. I mean, people, that's a biological instinct, because guys have to mate. They want somebody to could make babies, even though size doesn't matter with milk production. But anyway, so advertisers took advantage of men's biological attraction to women's breasts, and they put women with big breasts everywhere and on TV. And with that and Playboy and, you know, you mentioned my mother, because people were not breastfeeding at the time, because scientific formula by these medical doctors was better than breast milk. So you had this trifecta of events where women were just, you know, you had to have big boobs that made you attractive, and that's all she wrote. So Playboy was a huge influence, and then you wanted to be in Playboy, and, you know, men made the movies and men liked Playboy, and so you had to have big breasts, and it all links together in ways that I had no idea. And I, you know, you mentioned it. I mean, yeah, later I, well, yeah, Playboy comes up a few times in the book. Yeah. Because I did try out at one point, and then later, more recently, I met an executive who worked for Playboy and has a daughter, and it was like the whole Playboy. I mean, now you can see topless women and porn for free everywhere. Right. So clearly, Playboy is but Playboy is still pretty big in print. And you know, I have this Google boob alert, and they were talking about somebody in, you know, this print edition in another country of Playboy, and it was the biggest influence, you know, forever. And they only went naked for a couple of years because of Hustler. They had to compete, but they, Hugh Hefner and boobs, man, he made that happen. And it just happened to parallel my life, which is why the book works out as such a history of me and
a history of boobs,
even the songs. Yes. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So it was just this thing I had to write it.
Okay. So the event leading up to you getting breast implants was very unique. I'm just going to call it unique.
Okay.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about how the idea was planted.
Well, first I can tell you my mother hasn't read my book yet.
Okay. Well, here we go.
Yeah. She probably will read it this week. I'm a little nervous because she'll say, oh, I didn't mean it. No. But honest to God, I had a big birthday coming up. I didn't see my mom. My mom's a PhD. She was a woman's libber, although she had horrible history with my dad, who decided to be Mr. Playboy, like many men at that time. And I had nursed two children and was in, you know, a marriage, and was, my boobs looked like, you know, the gray donkey from Winnie the Pooh, who was with depressed little nipples going down. Eeyore. I had like Eeyore boobs. They were flat. I was just average small size. And when I finally was nursing, my boobs got huge. I loved them. But then, you know, they were for feeding the babies. And then they deflated so much, I just had these empty sacks of nipples hanging down. And I had this dress. I needed a strapless bra because my nipples stuck out. And I wanted to cover my nipples, and without just wearing a Band-Aid. My mom had bought me this beautiful pink silk dress that was kind of a bandeau top. Took me to Victoria's Secret, where of course nothing fit because they, you know, these women are just like alien women, and they didn't have a bra to fit anybody like me. And we're in the dressing room, and I had been wearing like camisoles for years, even with my husband, even having sex, because I was just so embarrassed about how my breasts look, which is a whole nother deal, right? But anyway, so we're in the dressing room, and my mother said I was deformed, and you know, I was really insulted. I was like, this is what it looks like when you breastfeed. You didn't breastfeed. And she said, you know, when my mom was younger, it was gauche. It was like D-class A to breastfeed. People who, you know, were middle class or above, they used formula because that was the big deal. Right. So she just thought I need to get a boob job. And for me, boob jobs were for bimbos. There was like no way. And I was just, you know, trying to be a writer and struggling and a mom. And that was just not going to happen. And so for years, she was like, well, men like boobs. And I asked my husband, and he was like, oh, no, I love you how you are. And then I turned around and he said, but, you know, if you wanted to. I actually did research, and they said if people get boob jobs during their marriage, that means there's a problem with the marriage. But, you know, that statistically, it's like somebody wants more. And I guess it's like that middle-aged red car kind of having big boobs. I don't know.
Yeah, but, it has become that for sure. Often people are not getting them when they're young. They're getting them as a sort of reinvention in their 40s or,
Right. And it is a thing with women, you know, the mommy makeover, they call it now, plastic surgeons. But anyway, ultimately, I did get a divorce from that husband. I was really struggling to get my business going. I had, you know, 24/7 custody, and I was kind of at a place where I was just working really hard. I hadn't started dating yet. And my mom was like, you know, she didn't want me to be lonely, and she thought I needed breasts because men like breasts. And I, for a couple of years, I was like, no, I'm fine. And then I had a big birthday coming up. I don't know if I was like in my late 30s, I think maybe 40. And in a moment of weakness, she was like, this doctor has an availability next week. And I just thought, I'll just go in for the consult. And had I thought about it, I never would have done it. But it was like this legit board certified doctor. And so I just went ahead and I did. I figured if I ever gonna, all my life I had wondered what would it be like to have boobs, right? So finally I did. I got a boob job. And then they were so freaking big. And I kept saying, can you make them small? Because I'm an intellectual. I'm a writer. I can't have big boobs. You know, because we judge women by their boobs, right?
Absolutely.
And they were like up to my neck. And I called him every day and complained. And he said, nobody's ever complained about having boobs that were too big. And, you know, they did go down and I got used to them. And I got to wear pretty bras. Like they, even though Victoria's Secret still didn't fit me. But they, you know, it was a great thing. And I got to say, I hated it. But they did make me feel womanly, and I did get my business back on track. And I felt, I didn't show them, but I just felt like I was a woman now. And it was a very bizarre thing. And I don't think, people ask me all the time if they should get boob jobs. And I say, I don't condone it. I think you should just love your body, but it's your body and you got to live in this world. And whatever you do, anyone who does anything to your body, make sure they're really good doctors and you've really figured it out. But for me, it was definitely, my mom said I was deformed, and I'm waiting to see this week and when she reads my book if she denies it. But oh my
god! But didn't she also totally say she'd pay for it? I mean, this
like, oh yeah, that was the deal.
Oh my god!
That was the thing. She would pay for it as a divorce gift.
Oh my god!
And that was the thing. It's expensive. I would never have done it. I really wanted money to pay my rent. Like I was broke. But that's not what she wanted to help with. That was not a gift. I needed to figure out how to support my daughters and I and, you know, move forward. But this would have been a gift. And so it was just, I just pulled that trigger and went for it. And it worked out for me. And then later, of course, I got breast cancer, but it had nothing to do with my implants.
Yeah, we're going to get to breast cancer. Yeah. But
yeah, no, it was definitely my mom. She believed, and she was raised to look like a playmate. And she was really intellectual, really smart, but beauty is a commodity of women, and there's just no denying
that. Oh, no, there absolutely isn't. But after you have a boob job, okay, so now you have boobs, which ostensibly you love and have wanted, but it's not like you stopped thinking about your boobs. That didn't stop. It just changed. There's still, you still had to focus on your boobs.
Oh, yeah, I did. Because I was dating, finally, and I, like, we were low, I mean, I had, you know, what you wear and how you cover your boobs affects whether you're working, whether you're going out for dates or, you know, all of that. And I had worn a low cut thing to have a date with this guy who I had met, you know, years earlier. And then when it came time to take my shirt off, I honestly decided to break up with him instead. I just thought he'd think I was a liar. I mean, everything about my boobs every day, I was conscious of them. It's always part of your identity and it makes you good or bad. Or it did for me.
Oh,
every day.
Fascinating. Okay. We're going to take another commercial break. There is a big challenge on the horizon next in the book. You face breast cancer. And so we're going to talk about that next. Stay with us. Are you ready to leave 2020 behind once and for all and set new intentions for 2021? For me, I want to be more mindful of what I'm putting into my body. And Saqqara has made that really easy. I'm going to be honest. Sometimes it's hard to prepare really healthy meals that also taste good. And I'm not that much of a cook or a chef. With Saqqara, you can reach your health goals without sacrificing taste. Their organic, ready-to-eat meals are made with powerful plant-based ingredients, and they're designed to boost your energy, improve your digestion, and get your skin glowing. They did do all that for me. It's no secret that I'm really picky about veggie burgers. In fact, the latest trend of making veggie patties that look, smell, and even bleed like real beef just creeps me out. So when I saw that Sakara had a signature burger on their menu, I was skeptical, to say the least. Well, I love this burger made of beans and grains. The texture, the taste, and the condiments. There was a homemade ketchup and some avocado spread. They just brought everything together. And that's what it's like for me and this food. I just always enjoy it. Sakara is a nutrition company that focuses on overall wellness, starting with what you eat. The menu of created, chef-crafted breakfasts, lunches, and dinners changes weekly, and it's delivered fresh anywhere in the U.S. Along with delicious plant-rich meals, Sakara also offers daily wellness essentials, like supplements and herbal teas to support your nutrition. Experience the power of plants as medicine with their best-selling Metabolism Super Powder. Made with organic raw cacao, it works to boost energy, eliminate bloating, minimize sugar cravings, and reduce fatigue. And right now, Sakara is offering our listeners 20% off their first order when they go to sakara.com/Tristan. Or you can enter code Tristan at checkout. That's Sakara, sakara.com/Tristan. You'll get 20% off your first order. This is a great deal. Do it now, sakara.com/Tristan. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with writer Leslie Lair, who has written this brand new book, it's just out, A Boob's Life, How America's Obsession with Breasts Shaped Me and You. So as I'm reading the story, I don't want to say it seemed like fate, but the role boobs played in your life was so consistent. And then you begin to face one of your biggest challenges, cancer, and it was all about your boobs again. Like if it were a fiction story, your editor would say, nope, too on the nose.
Yeah, but I have to say, I didn't think my life was about boobs at all until I looked back at it and connected the dots. For me, I just thought, that's how girls are. You know, we're always conscious of our body. Are we fat? Are we thin? How do we look? It didn't seem bigger than anything else. I was probably, and when I got cancer, I was more concerned with losing my hair than my breasts. But it was only looking back and connecting the dots for the book where I realized, in fact, the reason I wrote the book was because my husband accused me one night of being obsessed with breasts, and I was so insulted. I thought, that cannot be true. I'm a woman. I can't be obsessed with breasts. And we're listening to a late night show, and the guy makes a boob joke, and I was so pissed. And I realized, okay, he's right. I'm obsessed with breasts. But why? So I had to go back. But getting breast cancer was a shock. I hadn't known anyone who had breast cancer. It was about 6 years ago now, 7 years ago. And it wasn't, you know, it was the first year that I think football players wore pink, and it was
in solidarity for breast cancer research, the pink ribbons, exactly. All that shit. Right.
Yeah. And I just instantly hated pink. It's like, I was aware, but for me at the time, it wasn't ironic. Now it's like, okay, definitely this is my mission in life is all about breasts. And I have daughters and a sister and nieces I don't have the BRCA gene. I do come from Ashkenazi Jew, which I didn't even know. I mean, I've never felt more Jewish in my life until, you know, they wanted me to do all the genetic testing. It was just a freaky thing. I thought that I was completely healthy. I was a hiker. I ate really healthy. I was great, but I had an incredible amount of stress over my life due to various family dramas. And I really was kind of a person who tried to take care of everyone else all the time. And then I later learned that there's this ATF3 gene that's actually a trigger that stress causes that makes you vulnerable to breast cancer. So I'm now all about you know, self-care, take care of yourself. Stress is not good for us. And I know the Alzheimer's Association also talks about caregiver stress, mm-hmm. but it was a real surprise to me. It was random. And honest to God, had I not gotten that mammogram, I would be dead. So please get your mammogram. I'm really concerned about after the pandemic, what the numbers are going to be next year if people are not getting...
If they skipped their mammogram, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, 3.5 million women have had breast cancer. And until I was in college, really, or high school, it wasn't a disease that anyone even talked about. It was shameful because breasts represent women. We hug people, we feed people with them, we're caretakers. It was just kind of the women's disease. And it actually wasn't until President Clinton's mother died in the 90s, I think 1998, he finally was the first one to approve insurance coverage for reconstruction and a lot of breast cancer related things. But you couldn't even talk about it until, you know, probably in the 80s when or 70s, 80s, people started saying in magazines, admitting that they had it. So I didn't know anyone who had it. I knew someone who had done the walk, the breast cancer walk. But suddenly my world was breast cancer. It's a lifestyle. It's a very busy time.
I mean, certainly I've read accounts from cancer survivors about going through, and you had a lumpectomy, or I forget, it had another name maybe in your file. You kept your breasts. And then you had chemo, and then you had radiation. It was really grueling.
Yeah, it was not fun. And then, you know, 5 years of meds, mm-hmm. and people don't realize. I mean, I think that people who are actually in treatment generally tend to disappear. You don't see them. I would always wonder, like, there must be somebody else hiding out, going to the store at 6 a.m. or in bed for weeks. And, you know, where are all the other people going through chemo? It's totally not fun. If you can avoid it, avoid it. And I honestly, but I also was really lucky to get one of the drugs I got for a year with infusions. I was one of the first years of people who were approved to get it. And I know women who got the disease before I did and are dead now. I mean, there's so many variables of breast cancer. It's a freaky thing. It's really freaky. So,
and it seemed like you said, cancer is like a full-time job. All of a sudden, like your life revolves around treatment, the after effects of the treatment, going to appointments, doctors, not to mention the emotional stress and toll that it takes. So then it's like, okay, now I'm going to have this 5-year period where my life is once again going to revolve around my breasts.
Yeah, I have some friends who wrote for the book. They're musicians and wrote a book, and I helped write the lyrics of the song. It's a boob's life. It's this really campy song. It's on Spotify, but it's all about they can, you know, feed your babies, and they can give you life, and they can take it away. It was very fun to set music to it, but it's really true. I mean, I never felt so randomly close to death, you know. At the time.
Okay. So you kept your implants, you went through all of this, and then things start to go a little awry. You're told you're in remission, oh, yeah. And then all of a sudden one boob is harder than the other, like firmer, like rock hard. And you're having some pain. You have what you describe as Picasso boobs. Okay, yeah, so totally. Tell me about this period.
Well, I learned that I was going to have chemo, I immediately called my doctor and said, can you just take them off? I mean, after this point, Angelina Jolie just had a preventative mastectomy and, you know, got a great boob job after. And people are saying, oh, you just want a boob job, which is totally a myth. But I was like, take them off. And he said, no, it doesn't matter. The kind you had could come back anywhere, you know. I thought I was lucky to not have my boobs taken off, but it didn't matter. It could have come out anywhere. And so I had the same implants, but after radiation, and this can happen with any implants. It's like one of those little warnings that they say at the bottom of any drug, oh, blah, 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 and you just ignore it. And the radiation guy even said you can get, you know, your implants can do whatever contract. And that's what they did. My right implant, my wonky one, like, got tight and balled up to my collarbone. And I was like Picasso still, even now. And I've had them fixed once and almost again and well, you can find out in the book what else I tried. But it's like laying back in yoga. My one breast is kind of down to the side and my other one is up. I mean, everyone's boobs are a little bit uneven, but it was so painful having this one boob that balled up, and I was still had years of the meds, you know, right, that to prevent getting it again. And I went back to my doctor and he said, oh, it doesn't matter, you're alive. And the nurse in the office said, oh yes, you get used to it. And I'm thinking, you know, I was kind of a newlywed. It's like, I didn't want him to get used to, I didn't want to get used to that. And it hurt. And then I wondered how many hundreds of thousands of women are walking around with one breast up to their collarbone. And so I called my plastic surgeon and said, you know, can I like do something about this? And he said, yes, but once your skin is radiated, it may never be even. But I got the implants replaced. That's another thing. If you get breast implants, every 10 years, you're supposed to have them replaced again. It's totally a high maintenance thing. It's not something to do it impulsively. But anyway, so I told him that my cancer service surgeon, who is this fantastic genius guy, saved my life. He said, oh, don't worry. And my plastic surgeon was like, oh, well, why don't he have his balls cut off and see how he feels? Which was, to me, such proof of he got that breasts really are an aesthetic of womanhood. And so he was like, yeah, let's fix them. And then, you know, they're still not perfect, but I kind of got to the point when I was starting the book of how many times am I going to fix my boobs? How important are they into it? And are they to me? And why are breasts so important? And that's what the whole book is about. Breasts are important to our country as women. They're part of us. But having breast cancer, I know a lot of women who go through reconstruction. A lot of women don't. Like you were mentioning, some women get like tattoos, even for their whole breasts instead of getting breasts. But I also know women who spend years of various surgery. There's all kinds of different techniques of having your breasts rebuilt. And I mean, the things that women go through to have breasts so that they feel like women is just, it's just mind-boggling. And that's why, I mean, it's just evidence of how much breasts are part of the deal.
I mean, I think that's part of the tension here too. Like I remember when I first started making porn, I wasn't into the aesthetic of big fake boobs. And so I mostly cast people who had not had implants. And at one point I said to a fellow director of mine, I like natural bodies. And he was like, okay, right, let's interrogate that a little bit because, you know, you dye your hair, you have tattoos, you have piercings. Like what's natural, like your body has been modified and you've modified it to, you know, how you want it to, how you want to look. And so I think that he really challenged me on the term natural, right? Like is anything, yeah, you know, I mean, I also have screws in my foot. I mean, is anything natural about our bodies anymore? Especially in the time that we live in, right? People have like entire joints replaced. That's not quote natural, but it certainly improves our quality of life. So I think there's this tension, especially for feminists and people concerned about gender equity, which is there are these critiques of you got a boob job because the patriarchy, right? And it sort of stops there. And then knowing so many people in my life, because I know so many porn stars who've gotten implants, to talk to them about why they did it and how they feel about it, it really problematizes that whole thing of you got boobs because the patriarchy. And so it's like, I want women to have control over their own bodies, right? And in fact, we still don't in 2021. Our bodies are being legislated and criminalized, and we're still having control taken away from us at an institutional level. So I want people to be able to do whatever they want with their bodies. Right. And then, you know, I think that you tease out this tension, which is sort of body autonomy versus how much the culture shapes our idea of what's beautiful, what's womanly, what's sexy, right? What kind of body is the ideal body?
Right. I think for me, the whole thing is awareness. I think we just need to be aware what we're being fed and how much we're buying into it and how much we judge other people, and then also how much we judge ourselves. And I think on one hand, even in the gender issues now, when I was looking up statistics for one of the little fact sheets in the book, there was a whole separate category for transsexuals and top surgery, you know, which tends to be something that people wanting to switch into to the female sex.
But also on both ways, though. People who transition, it's one of the most accessible surgeries is to either have your boobs done or to have a mastectomy. And so, so when people think of medical interventions for transitioning, your chest is right up there.
Absolutely. It's just the first thing you see beyond the face. So for me, I think what I, you know, one of the goals, I want everyone to love your boobs, but I also want us to stop judging each other and be aware of how the culture is. And for me, that's where breasts pulls out further into not just that all women are equal, no matter what our boobs look like, you know, but we're equal to it, no matter what color our boobs are like, whether we're able or disabled with our what our boobs are like. And really to have this inclusionary sort of thing where all of us are have to be exactly equal, no matter what our bodies look like, no matter everything else looks like. And women have these other challenges, you know, that breast just makes us so vulnerable to. You know, I mean, for me, childcare is a big issue, but the whole opportunity. And I think people don't give enough weight to how much how we look and how people are judging us based on these cultural norms changes our opportunity.
Yeah.
So it's the awareness is just a huge issue for me. And for me, the awareness was a surprise.
And I think, you know, the gender landscape is really being entirely refashioned, both by people our age, younger, older, but especially by this next generation. And so I think we're really now trying to sort of tear down these traditional ideas. Like at some point, I hope in the world, not all, like right now today, not all women have breasts and not all women need breasts to be women. So I feel like we need to shift the culture in that isn't an identifier and a signifier that then automatically puts us into one gender, right? We gotta work on that. But I think we're working on it.
Absolutely.
Okay, Leslie, last question.
Okay.
How do you feel about your boobs right now?
Right now they're really comfortable. They're in barely a bra. And they kind of keep me warm at night, so I'm good with them. Mm. So, I think for me, one more point, though, I think it used to be that you could only be smart or pretty, and you know, it was women were judged if they were pretty, they had boobs; if they were smart, they were flat. I think what I fear now is that a lot of the younger generation who are being so great and forward, but a lot of them to make noise are having to be smart and pretty.
Mm.
And I'm hoping that that's not where we go, that we can start controlling our own narratives. And
this is like the Kardashian / Instagram effect, right? That the people, it's really interesting because the people who get the most attention, who have the most followers, and who therefore are also making the most money,
and exactly
are people who still have normative beauty standards, right? There still is this thing of, If you lined up, you know, the most popular people on social media
and on TV,
and on
Sophia Vergara, she's like a highest paid, the big boost.
Yeah,
but I do think that I really have great hopes for this younger generation. I think they, with opportunity, comes a lot of pressure.
Yeah,
and I'm both jealous that I fought so hard and wasn't able to do as much as I wanted, and yet it's such a big job and it's going to be really hard to do. So for me, I'm hoping that this book gets my voice out there just in a cautionary way to let people be aware that it's really important to stop judging people by our bodies or our skin color or our sexual identification and really just love yourselves and try and spread the word, you know?
The book is called A Boob's Life, How America's Obsession with Breasts Shaped Me and You. It's from Pegasus Books. You can get it wherever you buy books. And I especially encourage you to support local and independent businesses. You can find Leslie at leslielair.com, on Instagram and Twitter at leslielair1, as in number one. on Facebook. She is author Leslie Lair and on LinkedIn, Leslie Lair. Thank you so much for this conversation, Leslie, and for writing this book.
Thank you, Tristan. I really appreciate it and love you, boobs. It was really fun.
I'm going to shout out to my engineer and editor, A-Rod at FTC Designs, who you can follow on Twitter at FTC_designs. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. And if you like the show, it'd be great if you could review it or just, you know, tell five of your friends. That really helps with our visibility and gaining more listeners. I'm on social media at Tristan Taramino across all platforms. And I don't know when the next time will be that I wear a bra. Think on that. Okay, until next time.